Today I'm going, well, last Friday I introduced in gory detail the SU2 cross U1 standard model electroweak Lagrangian. And unfortunately, the gauge, there was no room in it for a gauge boson mass term, and no room in it for fermion mass term since it was chiral. Experimentally, the weak interactions are short-ranged, which means that at least some of the gauge bosons must acquire mass somehow. And this brings us, and the fermions must acquire mass somehow. So this brings us to spontaneous symmetry breaking and the Higgs mechanism. You've already seen in toy problems how spontaneous symmetry breaking of a global symmetry can lead to, of a chiral symmetry can lead to fermion masses. It's somewhat similar, although slightly trickier, to get the Higgs mechanism. So to do this, I'm going to return to the same sort of discussion that we had for Goldstone bosons. Now, however, I have two complex scalars in my Higgs doublet, phi plus and phi zero. And remember, when I write plus and zero, I'm anticipating that these will have electric charge plus one and zero, but technically we haven't even encountered electric charge yet. These are complex. It's convenient for present purposes to decompose each into two Hermitian fields. So I'm going to rewrite this as 1 over root 2 phi 1 plus I phi 2, and 1 over root 2 phi 3 plus I phi 4. And these are Hermitian. The Higgs potential, the scalar potential, which in the original complex basis was phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. When written out in terms of the Hermitian components, becomes 1 half mu squared phi 1 squared, well, sum I equals 1 to 4 phi I squared. Mass terms for Hermitian always have an extra half in them from here. And then plus lambda over 4, sum I equals 1 to 4, phi I squared, all squared. And you will immediately recognize that this is invariant under O4. Under an O4 global symmetry. Four real components, and this is clearly a rotational scalar in this abstract four-dimensional space. O4 is actually isomorphic to SU2 cross SU2, but that's not very relevant here. This is actually a larger symmetry than the entire Lagrangian. This term and the and the kinetic energy terms, gauge kinetic energy terms, are not O4 invariant. So this is what we call an accidental symmetry. Just part of the Lagrangian happens to have a larger symmetry than the theory as a whole. But we can make use of this O4 symmetry by noting that, well, we will choose, of course, lambda positive so that the vacuum is bounded below, and mu squared less than zero, so that because we want symmetry breaking. And then the potential only obviously depends on the magnitude, phi I squared. It doesn't care which direction in this four-dimensional space one picks. So in this case, I can, without loss of generality, I'm going to pick the vacuum expectation value in the phi 3 direction. I'm going to call this nu and the others are 0 for I equals 1, 2, and 4. And this is purely like choosing the z-axis in the convenient direction. If you'd made any other convention, then it would be equivalent to this by either an O4 rotation or actually an SU2 cross U1 rotation of the entire theory. In that case, I might have had to relabel some of my fields instead of plus and zero, but I mean, it would be equivalent. And you can see why I chose this. This is the real component of the one that I'm going to call electrically neutral. That was my convention. So the potential in terms of nu is this half nu squared plus quarter lambda nu to the 4. And for lambda positive and mu squared negative, that has the familiar shape that we've seen in previous contexts. So this is V of nu. And the minimum I will choose, without loss of generality, I will choose this vacuum. The others are just related by an O4 transformation. So nu is going to, well, the dV d nu is nu mu squared plus lambda nu squared. And this is 0 at the minimum. So nu is going to be minus mu squared over lambda square root. I guess I could get pedantic and say this is nu at the, that's the minimum of the nu at the minimum of the potential. So the potential is minimized for phi going to 1 over root 2, 0 nu. This is just the classical value at the minimum. And I'll sometimes call this V for, to represent the whole doublet. So this is really at the minimum or classical level. Now, of course, this is a one-dimensional plot. It's really a four-dimensional space, and there are rotations around here. I can't draw them. It's a four-dimensional space. But there's three directions involving Goldstone bosons, three rotations that will have massless excitations. But before I write that, notice that L1 acting on this vector, which is 0, 1, 1, 0, zero nu. This is not equal to zero. So the generator does not, the L1 generator is broken. It does not leave the ground state invariant. Or pictorially, L1 acting on this will take one into the, a different direction. Similarly, L2 of V is not equal to 0, and L3 of V is not equal to 0, and Y of V, which is a half times 1, 0, 0, 1, why is this half, is not equal to 0. So apparently, this at first sight suggests that all of the four symmetry generators of SU2 cross U1 are broken. However, that's not quite the case because the it's really the combination of QV, where Q is defined as L3 plus Y acting on V. Well, this is just one 0, 0, 0, root of 1 half, 1 over root 2, 0 nu. And this is 0. So the broken generators are L1, L2, L3 minus y are broken, and the symmetries associated with them are broken, but there remains one unbroken generator, L3 plus V, which is what I'm going to call Q, the electric charge, is unbroken. The vacuum is invariant, the ground state is invariant. And we say that SU2 cross U1 is broken to a subgroup, which is a U1, which we call U1Q. Sometimes one writes this as U1 sub Y, and these are just labels they're not group theory things, they're just labels which U1 we mean. So this simply means that the original symmetry has been spontaneously broken, but there is one U1 that remains, and that's electric charge. And I anticipated this when I was choosing my hypercharge assignments and so forth on Friday. Any questions so far? Yes.
Is it possible to tune the Lagrangian such that a different combination of L3 and Y is unbroken? Like, or is this unique?
Well, there was a question similar on Friday. Actually, if you think about it, if you were to take A L3 plus B Y, for example, that's really almost a trivial change, because remember, we have these gauge couplings and we have these hypercharges to choose. And so if you had what enters the actual gauge covariant derivatives are always things like G prime Y or G Li. And if you wanted to have something like this, I could just call B, Y, just call this Y prime, and or Y hat, and G prime Y would be G prime hat Y hat, where G prime hat is G prime over B. In other words, there's the normalization. You can always shuffle things back and forth between the gauge coupling and the normalization. So it's actually without loss of generality that you can set these to 1. As long as the coefficient's not 0, you can do it, and just it enters then in a different gauge. But the physics is the same. In fact, some books, some references will have everywhere I have written Y, sometimes they put a Y over 2. So that's just a okay. So now, so far all so good. And we expect from previous discussions that when one quantizes around this vacuum, so that was just the ground state here, the real theory will be something that you quantize around that, and I will call this W plus, this is meant to be a little w, nu plus h plus I, and that's a little z over root 2. W plus is a complex scalar, and z is a real scalar, and h is a real scalar. And these are the four components of my original field at when I actually quantize around the bound state. So remember, if you look down on the potential from above, I can only draw two directions here. It's really a four-dimensional O4 invariant. But I've chosen my axes, so here's the ground state. And then they're rolling in these directions, cost zero energy. So there's a Goldstone boson. I call that Z, massless particle. And quantizing in this direction costs you energy, so I call that H, which is, of course, the Higgs field. And that is a massive boson corresponding to excitations this way. The W plus, and is which is complex, it has two components, correspond to rolling in the two other directions that I can't really draw here. So there are three Goldstone bosons, W plus, W minus, and Z. It is convenient. So far, I've made no distinction, actually, between a gauge theory or a global symmetry. It doesn't matter for anything I've said so far. It is convenient to not use W plus, W minus, and Z as my parameters when quantizing, but to make a change of variables. And the change of variables is to rewrite this as 1 over root 2 times E to the I sum J equals 1 to 3, and I'll call it L bar J psi J. So I exponentiate matrix and then 0 nu plus H over root 2. L bar 1 is L1. L bar 2 is L2, L bar 3 is L3 minus Y. These are simply the 2x2 matrices corresponding to the three broken generators. And you can see that this is a nonlinear transformation. It introduces three fields, Psi1, Psi2, and Psi3, that are related. You could do a power series expansion in the size and to leading order. These are basically up to some root 2s and so forth, are just these three fields, but it's a reparametrization. There's actually a theorem in field theory that if at the classical level you reparametrize with things like this, you have an equivalent theory. All of this hinged on the fact that nu was not zero. If nu were zero, I couldn't really do this. This change of variables is very convenient because when I go to my Higgs potential depends just on phi adjoint phi. And if I take phi adjoint phi, this factor cancels. So phi adjoint phi is just 1/2 nu plus h squared. And so with this reparametrization, the three Goldstone bosons, which are really representing that rolling, and they're representing it better, they actually are a better representation of the rolling around the curve than the original was, because they take into account that it's a circle and not a straight line. Anyway, the Goldstone bosons disappear. From V of phi. They do not disappear from the rest of the Lagrangian necessarily. They, in particular, they disappear from the potential, and the potential is completely independent of the Goldstone bosons, and clearly they are massless. There's no mass terms for them in the potential. Now, this could have been done just as well for a global symmetry. And in fact, this is done for treating global symmetries as a computational tool. It's done all the time. The phis for a global symmetry do not entirely disappear from the theory. They still have kinetic energy terms. And in some theories, in this case, that's all that they would have. So they don't entirely disappear from the theory. there, because the derivatives of phi are still can act on this piece. However, the whole point of a gauge theory was that this type of, this is just a gauge transformation. The psis are three functions of space. I'm doing everything before quantizing, so I can say these are my betas of an SU2 cross U1 transformation associated with these three generators. And the whole point of the gauge theory was that the form of the Lagrangian was unchanged under these transformations. Now, it's not going to be totally unchanged in this case because I've broken the symmetry, but let me just go on. The next step, the one point where things differ from the global symmetry is the so-called Kibble transformation. So far, I've just defined new parameters. The Kibble transformation says, make a gauge transformation with beta I equals minus psi I. And go to a gauge in which phi takes the form 1 over root 2, 0, nu plus h. This is called the unitary gauge. It's the gauge in which the Goldstone bosons entirely disappear from the Lagrangian. You don't see them anywhere. And it's the best gauge for sort of discussing the physics of the theory. It's not the best gauge for doing high order Feynman diagrams. It's trickier to deal with renormalizability, but it's a good gauge for that. Okay, yes. Because to some extent they're not, well, that'll become a little more apparent in a moment. The gauge boson, the Goldstone bosons are going to reemerge in a second because the three of the four gauge bosons are going to become massive, as we'll see in the next line practically. Now, we started out with a massless spin one particle. A massless spin one particle has 2 degrees of freedom, helicity plus one and helicity minus one. There's no helicity zero longitudinal component from massless gauge boson. A massive gauge boson necessarily has 3 spin states, plus one, zero, and minus one. That longitudinal mode is just the Goldstone boson reemerging in a new guise. And this, in this gauge, that's totally transparent and obvious. In other gauges, the physics is the same, but the psis are still floating around and it's hard to interpret some of the terms. Yes?
Just an observation. In the unitary gauge, the kinetic terms for psis also
disappear. It what?
In the unitary gauge, the kinetic terms for the psis also disappear, right?
Yes.
Okay, so now let me actually rewrite the, this is just basically picking up on the two comments that were just made. Let me now write the kinetic energy term for, now the point is I want to rewrite the whole theory in this gauge in terms of this. And the V of phi is just, this term and the square of it with appropriate coefficients. I'm not going to talk in detail about the Higgs sector today. I'll do that maybe tomorrow or Wednesday. But it's very similar to what I did with the single complex scalar. So the potential will lead to just a positive mass squared term for H plus an induced cubic plus a quartic plus a cosmological constant. What I want to focus on now, though, is the kinetic energy term for the Higgs doublet. And this will give, well, it does indeed give a canonical kinetic energy term for the H field. But the important part is the part involving the gauge degrees of freedom. So this is just the rho vector. Let me write it and then talk about it. So first of all, I did the trivial rewriting that this is 0 nu times 1 plus h over nu. So my gauge covariant term for the Higgs field does change form because of the nu here. I have broken the symmetry spontaneously after all. And I pulled out the 1 plus h over nu squared term. For the moment, I'm more interested in just the vacuum part. So here's the 0 nu, and then 0 nu as a rho vector, and I pulled out the 1 over root 2 squared, and then this is squared. So I have something that's quadratic in the W and B fields, and that's a mass term. And so I have generated by this mechanism mass terms for the W and B. Now let me write it out in a little bit more detail. I'm not going to go through all the manipulations of the writing the taus in terms of raising and lowering operators. I just want to write the answer here. So I have that this is d mu h squared over 2 plus mw squared w plus w minus, and I will define all these things momentarily, times 1 plus h over nu squared plus mz squared over 2 times z mu times 1 plus h over nu squared plus, well, that is it. Now I have to define all these things. W plus and minus are defined just like I've done in the context of the Fermi theory. 1 over root 2 W 1 minus or plus I W 2. So this is a complex spin a half particle, and this will be positively charged and its complex conjugate. To really identify that this is positive and negative charges, you have to look at the L gauge, but let me just take my word for it now that these will be positively charged. They are massive with a mass MW, turns out to be G nu over 2. The Z mu is a rotation by some angle called theta W, where W stands for Weak or Weinberg, depending on who you ask. It is a rotation of the two neutral bosons, the W3 from SU2 and the U1 from the B from U1. And the orthogonal combination, which does not appear here because it's massless, is cos theta W B plus sine theta W W3. And this is the photon, or the electromagnetic vector potential more precisely. The Z mass is root G squared plus G prime squared over 2 times nu, and which is same as MW over cos theta W. And this angle is defined by the ratio of the two gauge couplings gives the tangent of the angle. So I claim, I'm not going to go through this, that will be something you think about this afternoon, but it follows in a fairly straightforward way from what's up on the top board there. So we have generated three massive, W plus, W minus, and Z, three massive vector fields corresponding to the three broken generators, and one remains massless, the gauge boson of the unbroken U1. Yes?
So when you chose to parameterize your scalar field with the three broken generators, and then you did a gauge transformation, why does it matter which generators you choose? Wouldn't any, I mean, couldn't you just choose a linear combination of generators then gauge that term away? I mean, why did you choose the broken generators? I don't see how that shows that.
Well, the unbroken generator could have been chosen also, but the if I had included that, that just annihilates the ground state, so it wouldn't have done anything.
Oh, I see. So it's just to make sensible.
I can only do this for broken generators. So this is basically it. Let me, the MA, of course, is zero. And this weak angle has a lot of different expressions. But another expression that's equivalent is that sometimes uses sine squared theta W is 1 minus MW squared over MZ squared. That follows easily from this, from this form. These are all equivalent forms. Yes.
So what determines or motivates the weak angle? Like, how does that transformation show up?
This is just algebra. If you plug, if you just go to that Lagrangian up there, go through the algebra, you will get this.
Is it because we want something, we want a field with the obvious mass term? Like, why don't we just write our, like, expand our original Lagrangian in terms of, like, B and W and call those our fundamental fields, as opposed to the W's and Z's?
Because this form doesn't have any manifest gauge invariance to it. The W and Z have different masses, and so it's not directly a gauge invariant. So, yeah.
I think the answer, what I would say is that that hides the fact that the W plus and W minus are charged.
And there's also, there's a mass mixing. You want to write your theory in terms of mass eigenstates, and the B and the W3 component, they're not mass eigenstates, whereas the A and the Z, the photon and the Z boson, are mass eigenstates. So there's a mass mixing. When you square that term up top, you get a cross term between B and W3, and you want to get rid of that, so you're talking about the actual physical states of your theory. And so that's where these mixing angles come from, because you're diagonalizing some 2x2 matrix.
Let me also say that this sort of intricate interconnection is necessary if you want the two components of the doublet to have different electric charges. I could devise some SU2 cross U1 theory in which the breaking was, the unbroken U1 was just the U1 I started with, and that would be fine, except in that case, the two components of the doublet would have the same electric charge, and that's not what nature does. So. Okay, so let me state a couple other aspects of this. I'm not going to, at this point, prove it. Some of these things you will prove, and some I will go through in a bit more detail later. But some of these quantities are related to other things that we either know at this point or don't know. For example, the Fermi constant, which we know, it's Fermi constant, remember, was about 1.17 times 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2 from mu decay. Turns out that this is related to the other quantities in this way. The way that comes about is that the weak interaction mediated by this W will, in the appropriate limit, reduce to a first approximation to the Fermi theory, and that is the relation that you will find when you work it out. So we have one constraint on our parameters. What I'm trying to do now is just figure out the parameters, because we need to figure out G, we need to figure out nu, and we have to figure out theta W from experiment. And however, if you look at this expression, the G actually cancels from this, so that we have nu is equal to 2mw over G is equal to 1 over root 2 G Fermi. equal to 1 over root 2 G Fermi. And we know G Fermi, so this is 246 GeV. So we know one of the parameters, nu. It's from the scale of the weak interactions that was measured, well, roughly in 1934, but more precisely since then. We will see, and I'm just going to state it for the moment, but we're going to see that little g, this SU2 gauge coupling, is related to E of electromagnetism by G is E over sine theta W. Furthermore, we will see that sine squared theta W is approximately 0.23. This comes from predictions. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I just want to give some idea of these parameters. This, the W and the A were there before, and the new prediction is the interactions mediated by the Z boson, plus the existence of the W and Z. That's what's new. And those new interactions mediated by the Z are going to depend in their strength on this parameter, and that's how it was first measured. And so once one knows sine theta this, and since we know E, that tells us G. I'm not going to write down a numerical value. That's not so important. The once we know G and sine theta W, et cetera, we can predict. Well, I made a comment last week that you might guess that G was the same order as E, and you see, it is. I mean, there may be some factor of 2 or something relating them, but it's similar order. Okay, so MW is therefore MZ cos theta W. MZ is a little larger, and this is G nu over 2, and this in turn is pi alpha over root 2 G Fermi all to the 1/2 sine theta W, and this is predicted to be about 78 GeV, and MZ predicted to be about 89 G GeV. This is all at tree level. There are higher order corrections that raise these predictions by 2 or 3 GeV. Let's say, I'll just say 80 and 91. The W and Z were in fact discovered. Well, the first thing that was discovered was this neutral current, so-called mediated by the Z, and this led to the measurement of this angle. Then these bosons were discovered directly at CERN in the 1980s, and they have the correct mass. And then I won't have much time to talk about it, but there was about a 20-year period of more and more precise measurements, especially of the Z and its decay properties. And the mass of the Z is now known to 10 parts in a million. It's the most precise measurement in high energy domain that's ever been made. And basically, it can be predicted to almost as good a precision from other measurements, and everything's in essentially perfect agreement. So it's an incredibly successful theory, including all of the higher order corrections that I don't have time to talk about. In addition to predicting the neutral current and the W and Z, this is a renormalizable theory, so one can calculate everything to higher orders, which is needed. They would have been divergent in the Fermi theory. Okay. Now, I'm going to, I should say something about the Higgs interactions. I'm going to talk about the Higgs in more detail tomorrow or Wednesday. But you can see that there are 3- and 4-point interactions. For example, if you expand this out, this is 1 plus 2h over nu plus h squared over nu squared. So that means there will be vertices of z, z, Higgs, or z, z, Higgs, Higgs. And what's important is that the strength of these vertices is proportional to mz squared, proportional to the mass of the particle. So this one, this one is proportional to mz squared over nu, and this one is proportional to mz squared over nu squared. Since mz is a considerable fraction of nu, that's fairly large. And in fact, it was this vertex and the analogous one for the W that were extremely important in the searches for and eventual discovery of the Higgs. But I'll talk about that more later. I don't want to go into that aspect right now. Questions so far? Okay, now I want to turn to the interactions of the gauge bosons with the fermions, the L phi part. Now that has to be done in two stages. The first thing I have to do is go to that, remember I had that complicated Yukawa interaction with all those non-Hermitian matrices and everything. Well, one has to look at that and figure out what the physical fermions are and their masses. And I'll turn to that in a moment, but let me do sort of a simplified discussion of the LF first, and I'm going to basically just write it. So recall that for the fermions, we had a sum of terms. For example, it was, I'll just write one example. It was q bar left I times d slash q left, where d mu q left was d mu plus I g tau dot w, well, tau dot w over 2 plus 1/6 I g prime b times q left. And there were similar things for all the other fermions. Let's see if I did that correctly. So clearly, there's going to be vertices connecting the q left to the w and to the w plus or minus and to the w3 and to the b. And I wrote those things out in some detail on Friday. So let me first consider a simplified model with one family. Just the UD left, nu E left, and then the right-handed fields. Because all the complications come in when you have more than one family. So I'm just going to write it out here. You can take all these gauge covariant derivatives and express the W's and B's in terms of the mass eigenstate gauge bosons, and you will obtain the following LF. You will have the, first of all, the ordinary kinetic and mass terms, which I haven't written yet. I will also eventually talk about how the Higgs couples to fermions, but that's, I just want to write the gauge interactions now. And then I get minus g over 2 root 2 times j w mu times w minus mu plus j w mu dagger w mu plus, where, and there's going to be more terms, but the w plus and minus are already defined, and the j mu w is just nu bar e gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 e plus u bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 d. This was just the charge raising current from the Fermi theory, V minus A. And it's V minus A because the SU2 only acts on the left chiral field, it's chiral. So this term is going to reproduce all the charge current interactions. And in particular, if you have some process involving the exchange of a W with a J dagger here, and it has momentum Q, I've said this before, when that propagator is Q 1 over Q squared minus MW squared, and this goes like minus 1 over MW squared when the momentum transfer squared is small compared to the mass. So in that limit, if for a physical process you can neglect the q squared, I claim that this is going to reproduce the Fermi Lagrangian and that you will get this relation. That will be an exercise. Yes?
So, I mean, you wrote there heuristically kinetic and mass slash Higgs.
Yeah.
But the mass terms usually come from the u comma, right?
Yeah, that's what I meant. The mass.
I have not yet written the Yukawa thing. That will generate the fermion mass. It will also generate a coupling to the physical Higgs. And it will also, when I go to three families, it will generate the mixings. At this point, I just want to write the gauge currents. I mean, there's so many aspects to this, I have to do them one at a time.
That is Ming here because LF, you wrote LF equals They don't come from the same LF that you wrote down initially. That's all I want.
LF plus open color. Yeah. Okay, this is only the first term.
There are two more terms. I broke the little, or this came off the clip. Okay, I think that's all right. Okay, so obviously that term comes from the W1 and W2.
The W3 and B terms give, when rewritten in terms of the Z and A, give you two more pieces. The first is minus G prime over root g squared plus g prime squared times j mu q times a mu, where jq is the electromagnetic current. It is the sum over u, d, u, and e of q psi bar gamma mu psi, where Q is equal to 2/3 minus 1/3, 0, and minus 1, 4. This is just the familiar electromagnetic
current. And I'm still, I'll have to fake it for now. Oh, here. Okay, so electromagnetism will emerge from this, provided that we identify this as E, which is G sine theta W. For the way I define theta W, clearly sine theta W is G prime over root G squared plus G prime squared. Another useful identity you see sometimes is 1 over e squared equals 1 over g squared plus 1 over g prime squared. Okay, the third term is minus root g squared plus g prime squared over 2 jz mu times z mu, where z mu is defined there. It's the neutral massive boson. And jz mu, which is called the weak neutral current, the new thing predicted by this, turns out to be the sum psi equals u d nu and E of T3 psi left psi bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 psi minus 2 sine squared theta W times J mu Q, where T3 psi left is equal to plus 1/2, minus 1/2, plus 1/2, and minus 1/2, again for U, D, nu, and E. So the weak neutral current, which was predicted, involves one piece that is violates parity and charge conjugation maximally, just like the J charge current, and it involves T3, and that is at least in part from the tau 3 W3 up there. The second part is proportional to the electromagnetic current. It's not parity violating, it's pure vector, it's reflection invariant, it's charge conjugation invariant, and the coefficient is this 2 sine squared theta W. So those are the gauge interactions for one family. With three families, one has to be a little more careful about mass eigenstates and so forth. But let me So again, the weak charge current plus QED incorporated and a weak neutral current plus the W and Z predicted. And soon after this theory was written down, neutral current was observed. Now, a typical neutral current reaction would be the following. You can have, for example, nu mu E could, by the charge current, produce a mu minus nu E. That would be so. Neutrino scattering of this form was predicted, existed even in the Fermi theory. And at high enough energies, you would have to include the propagator here. But now, so this is weak charge current. But now, nu mu E goes to nu mu E via Z exchange was predicted and subsequently observed. Many, many other neutrino scatterings observed. You can scatter from protons. You can have deep inelastic scattering in which you have a proton come in and then inelastic final states. You can have, I won't go through it, but you can do nu E, E goes to nu E, E. And it turns out that processes like this involve both neutral current and charge current, which can interfere with each other. You can write down the Feynman graphs yourself. So a whole host of neutral current processes involving neutrinos. The weak neutral current also led to atomic parity violation. We usually think of the force, say, between an electron and a proton as a Coulomb force. I'll write it as a proton. And this is what we usually think is responsible for holding atoms together. But actually, within this theory, we have another component, the so-called weak neutral current. And this contributes, say, for a non-relativistic system, this contributes a contribution to the potential between the electron and proton. This is weaker by 5 or 6 orders of magnitude than this, but it violates parity. And this doesn't violate parity. So if you look for some phenomenon in atomic physics parity violating, you're sensitive to this. And for example, when you studied the hydrogen atom as an undergraduate, you were told about S and P waves, L equals 0, 1, 2. And you knew they had opposite parity. And you never worried about mixing of S and P waves. But this can lead to the energy eigenstates of a hydrogen atom can actually have mixtures of P wave mixed in with the S wave. And this has been observed now in detail in heavy, in the cesium atom especially, which is a heavy hydrogen-like atom. It's, and so this has been studied in detail. Yes, there was a question.
I was just wondering how the C-chloride violates parity, because it looks like that the part that is E minus, E minus.
This part.
Does that include E minus to E minus?
This is a sum over
U, D, nu, and E. One term is the electron with a coefficient minus a half, E bar gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5E. And so the dominant effect there is actually the one in which it's, here's the 1 minus gamma 5 part here. Well, it's, this is vector, this is axial, and that's vector. The dominant thing is the gamma 5 part in the electron vertex and the part not involving gamma 5 here. Although the other way comes in also, much smaller. This has also been studied in things like electron, actually deuteron goes to electron X, deep in elastic scattering, leading to some parity violating effects that would not be there if it were just one photon exchange. In 1989, the LEP accelerator, which was at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, E minus E plus produced a Z on shell, and then it decayed into everything it could decay into, started, and something like 10 to the 8 Zs were produced, and their decays, their branching ratios, their angular distributions, their parity violating effects were studied in enormous detail, and everything agreed with standard model. The other thing that this did, in addition to predicting these, it made the theory sensible for high order calculations. You can already start here. The, for example, beta decay is measured very, very precisely, and one really needs to calculate higher order corrections. If nothing else, you know, in beta decay, you can exchange a photon between, say, the electron and the proton, and that's a higher order correction to the W exchange. And those corrections are meaningless in the Fermi theory. They're divergent, non-renormalizable. But everything becomes meaningful in this theory. And so many, so the precision is such that the radiative corrections have been measured at the one part in a thousand level as well. And these weak neutral current processes, they actually predicted the top quark mass, because the top quark enters as a loop in a radiative correction that allowed its prediction, many other things. I'll say maybe a bit more about that tomorrow. But tomorrow what I want to do is talk about the, go back to the L. Yukawa and talk about the CKM matrix and how that emerges.